Thank you so much for inviting me. It's such a pleasure to be here with an old friend like Jean-Noël, who I've known for over 30 years. I will not read a paper. I will talk about the slides. And I apologize for speaking in a barbarian language like English. I have long been interested in a genre of literature called Touketsu, where Japanese monks would write to their Chinese counterparts. And this was frequently done within Tendai. In connection with that topic, there was an exchange between Genshin and Shime Chire, Seming Jirli, in China. These were two of the brightest people of their century, I think. It was a complete disappointment. Genshin asked incredibly boring questions, and Jirli frequently said, "We don't have that text now." Ando Toshio did a very nice article on it, and I went through and I read the original sources, because I was curious to see whether he was correct. I think he was absolutely right. It is a boring exchange. I mentioned that to introduce the topic, because Japanese Tendai is so completely different from Chinese Tiantai. And yet at the same time, Japanese Tendai monks deeply respected the works by Jirli, by Janran, and yet they interpreted them in very different ways. And that's sort of what this paper's about in terms of Rongi. I will talk about two different, maybe three different people. I want to briefly introduce Shunjo, who I think is a fascinating person. And then we'll jump to about a century later, and we'll talk about a man named Jitsudo Ninku. And Ninku is responsible for writing many, many debate manuals, many lectures. You find more by Ninku in Tendai Shuzensho, Zoku Tendai Shuzensho, than almost anybody else. When we talk about his Rongi, we're talking about something very, very different, I think, than many of the Rongi you've heard about. For Ninku, who was never Tendai Zasu, he was abbot of Rozanji in Kyoto, and then of Sangoji, which is a Jodoshu Seizanha temple. So his Rongi were really within his school alone. They were not defending Tendai against other people. They represented an educational system. And he asked that all of his monks participate in Rongi. You can get a sense of the quality of that educational system when you look at these, because people would take very detailed notes and write extensively about the contents of the Rongi. The records we have are much more fuller than the things I've seen from other traditions of Rongi. The other thing, final thing I'd like to say to introduce this is, at least in America, we spend a lot of time arguing about Kemitsu Taisei and so forth. I think maybe that makes sense if you're a historian like Kuroda Toshio, but if you look at Tendai from within, Tendai is completely fractured. There are so many different schools or lineages that do not agree. And that's the case with what I'm going to talk about today. Ninku's Rongisho represent only his own tradition. So there would be other Tendai traditions that would completely reject what he was saying and be very different. So a very brief biography of Shunjo. He studies Tendai and esoteric Buddhism when he's young. When he's 17 to 19 years old, he listens to lectures about Daoshuan Dosen, Nanzan Dosen's Gyojisho for about 2 years. And he's very impressed by this. He is convinced that if you do not follow precepts, you cannot be saved. And so as a Tendai monk, he does something very interesting. He goes to Kanzeonji in Kyushu, which is a temple where they would have used the Shibunritsu, not the traditional Bomokai that Tendai used. So he would have been more affiliated at that point with Rishu types of interpretations. But he wants to understand the difference between Tendai and Nara Buddhism. And so he travels to a number of places, temples, and finally he hears about a man named Lingjer Yuanzhao. And Yuanzhao, if you read about Song Dynasty Buddhism, Yuanzhao and his interpretation of monastic discipline is incredibly important. He's all over the place. He writes almost 100 fascicles of texts about Daoxuan's works, about other problems in Vinaya, and so forth. He also stresses Pure Land. So it's really precepts in Pure Land. And once Xunzhou hears about him, he decides to go to China. And when he's in China, he will study for 3 years. He'll study Vinaya under a man, Ruan Liaohong, which is who's located in Mingzhou, which is close to Shime, to Mount Shimesan, which is the headquarters for that whole Shime Chire type of tradition. And then he'll spend about 8 years studying Tendai, or Tiantai, particularly the type represented by Shime Chire. his teacher, a man named Beifeng Zunyan, was an avid defender of Shime Chire's, Semin Jirli's position. When Xunzhou comes back after 12 years of studying in China, he brings back an incredible collection of texts, which would have made his temple probably the headquarters of Song Dynasty, the study of Song Dynasty Buddhism in Japan. So he brings back 700 fascicles of works on Tiantai. That probably was the entire corpus of Tiantai works. We don't know the titles of these books because the bibliography of what was included has not survived. He brings back 300 fascicles of texts on Vinaya, Bodhisattva precepts, as well as many texts on Huaya and on Confucianism, some on Taoism. An amazing bibliophile. He loved books. While he's in China, he studies monastic procedures, and he goes to a rainy season retreat on Mount Tiantai. And later, when he goes back to Japan, he will write about this. Most of his works have not survived. We don't have very much by him, but researchers seem to, every 5-10 years, they discover something new. And so we have a pretty good idea of what he wanted to do in terms of monastic discipline. When he finally comes back, he has a profound influence on many Japanese monks. Eisai goes to welcome him, and it's almost at the end of Eisai's life, and he brings him back to Kenin-ji in Kyoto, and they stay there together for a little while. Then they have a big fight over whether monks can wear silk robes or not. And Xunzhou says, no, you shouldn't wear silk. And so they part ways. Dogen probably met him, although we don't have proof of that, but there's a good article that makes the case that he did. Xunzhou influences Rishu, so Vinaya school monks. He gives them Yuanzhao's sub-commentaries on Daoxuan's works. Rishu, by the time Xunzhou goes to China, they've really lost their tradition. They really don't know what Vinaya is, and they make basic mistakes in understanding it. When they get the commentaries that Xunzhou brings back, it is a huge impetus to them. So this man was very important for them. Finally, we can think about what influence did these 700 fascicles of works have on Japanese Tendai? I think very little. I before I stuck my neck out and said what I'm going to say, I talked to Matsumoto-san, who knows much more about this than I do. When you look at Tendai CDs, which have digitized text for Hochibo Shoshin, who's very close to Chinese Tendai positions, you don't find Jurly mentioned much, hardly at all. So what I'm going to do is not talk about that, but another aspect of what he brings back. Did Yuan Zhao's works have much influence on Tendai interpretations of precepts? And the answer, to give you the answer before I talk about it, is not much. Ninku absolutely rejects them. He does not like what he sees of Chinese Tendai positions on precepts. Anyway, Shunjo was enormously important in Japan at that point. This is an image of him that's done fairly early. I thought it was interesting just because he's sitting in a chair, whereas you looked at the images of Tenkai a few minutes ago, he's not sitting in a chair. This is very much a Chinese sort of position, I think, for that type of portrait. And when Shunjo introduces these monastic discipline works, he says you should pronounce them Chinese style, not Japanese style. So let's see. This is a picture of one of the texts that survives. This is the manuscript of the Golden Light Repentance Ritual. And off to the side is written the Chinese, his version at least of the Chinese pronunciation. So when they would do rainy season retreats, again they would use Sung Dynasty pronunciations. It reminds me a little bit of what you find today if you go to Mampukuji and you listen to the Obakumug sort of chanting and using quasi-Chinese pronunciations. A few things, part of the list of things he brings back. Relics of the Buddha, one relic of Samantabhadra of Fugen Bosatsu, which he tells you a little bit about how that happens. The monk was praying on Omeshan, and a relic magically appeared in his hands. 18 paintings of, arhats, images of Daoxuan and Yuan Zhao. These pictures, silk paintings, would be copied, and they put in temples around Nara, where they would be following Shunjo's instructions. Again, both seated on chairs. So this is a brief, very brief introduction to Shunjo and why he was so interesting and so important, I think. What was his position on precepts? And here, this is based on, again, we don't have very much that he wrote, but this is based on a very short work that he supposedly orally gave to his magodeshi, to his grandson disciple, a man named Jōin. And here he sort of classifies the views on precepts. And what you'll see is these are not monolithic categories. There's a lot of room for interpretation. He writes, there are many ways of categorizing Hinayana and Mahayana precepts preached by Shakyamuni during his life, but they can be summed up in the following four categories. First is the sudden teachings of the Fanwangjing of Bomokyo. These are for those with pure and perfect faculties. He uses the term Jun Enki. And Enki, perfect faculties, is a term that was made popular, particularly by Saicho, who claimed that all Japanese had perfect faculties, and so you didn't need to use the Hinayana precepts at all. So here he's clearly referring to Japanese Tendai, and he puts that out first. And if this is a hierarchical list, which it may be, it's hard to tell. I think there's that in it. He sort of puts that at the bottom. He thinks Japanese Tendai has really gone away from where they should be. Second is the gradually established rules of the deer park. These are purely Hinayana. This is Vinaya, and this would be Rishu. precepts formulated in accordance with wrongdoing and so forth. And then he says, secondarily, they rely on the 58 precepts of the Bomokyo. So this would have been very much in keeping with, say, what Ganjin had introduced to Japan, I think, and so forth. Third is a category that includes the Shanja Jing, Zenkai Kyo, and Yinglo Jing, Yorak Kyo, which is a strange category because these two texts completely disagree when they talk about the three collections of pure precepts. But they both have three collections. They're both seen in a hierarchical way. And so Shunjo links them together. And finally he says, it's like climbing a multi-story building in which not a single story can be omitted. In other words, one goes from the Hinayana, actually, you go from five lay precepts, novice precepts, full precepts, bodhisattva precepts in this system, and you could not omit any of those. but he says, these people don't realize the pure teaching. And finally, he says, he gives you his own position. Fourth is the position of the Lotus Sutra and the Nirvana Sutra, in which the Hinayana is identified with the Mahayana. So there is a passage in Nirvana Sutra that I think is very important to him where he says, Nirvana Sutra says, if you want to see the, see Buddha nature, you must follow the precepts. You cannot omit them. In a sense, what Shunjo is doing is he's saying, Hinayana is equal to Mahayana in those terms. So we have other views of what was going on at that time, because Shunjo was not the only person trying to understand this. This is a man, Echin, who's from the Kurodani lineage. So very, very different from Ninku. And I'll just read the underlying passages. The Senyuji precepts are Hinayana, but differ from those in Nara. So they're different from Rishu, because their practices are Mahayana. They differ from Nara insofar as they open the 250 Vinaya precepts using the Lotus Sutra's passage stating, that which you practice is the Bodhisattva path, and thus using the opening and reconciling approach to the precepts. In other words, they use kaie to explain it. So you open up the Hinayana precepts and show that, in fact, they are completely in agreement with Mahayana teachings. Okay, and then he talks about his own. Our Tendai precepts are the wondrous precepts that are perfect and sudden. This is Endon Kai. And they go straight to Buddhahood. In other words, Jikyo Endon Myokai, the wondrous precepts that go straight to Buddhahood. Saicho really liked terms like Jikido, direct path, Jikyo, direct going, things like that. And so he's playing on that. What's interesting about this is in saying that, he's saying we don't need to use a kaie approach anymore. That would be silly. We just have the pure precepts, perfect precepts, that go straight to what we want. And so you see with Kurodani Ryu, they're rejecting kaie at this point. And Ninku would pretty much do the same thing. I wanted to just read you the passage from Nirvana Sutra that talks about Vinaya precepts, Buddha nature. In the Nirvana Sutra, the Buddha says, I preached if sentient beings have violated precept from the four parajikas down to the dushkritas, the most minor precepts, they must strictly repent. If they do not observe the precepts, how will they see Buddha nature? By seeing Buddha nature, they will realize supreme enlightenment. Eventually, Shunjo and his tradition will leave Lotus Sutra behind, I think. And they do that because they're troubled by two different approaches found in Lotus Sutra. So you have Anraku Gyo, comfortable practices, which reject any consorting with Hinayanas at all. And then you have the passage I read earlier in which Shakyamuni preaches to a shravaka, to a hinayana, that which you're practicing is the bodhisattva path. I have to decide what I'm going to read and what I'm not. Ryoa is really interesting. He's a Tendai monk who later converts to Jodo Shu, but he writes some really interesting things about precepts, but we'll skip him and just go to Jitsudo Ninku, who is sort of the heart of this. This man, I think, is brilliant, and he's also not a standard Tendai thinker. He's willing to deviate from things and have his own views on things. I wanted to sort of explore how he was reacting to the text that Shunjo brought. And to do that, I chose two topics. One is, what is the difference between Hinayana and Mahayana precepts, which is a sort of a debate area. And the second was Kaitai, essence of the precepts. And these two were core topics within internal debates within Tendai Shu. To do that, I used two different types of literature. Endonkai Gyoji Sho is a set of 10 lectures that he gave. And by lectures, you get a sense of what his position really is. The Kaiju Sho is much more of a debate manual. And when you read debate manuals, you always have to be careful, because frequently they present the topic that later they will criticize. to begin with, Ninku is quite aware of Yuan Zhao, and he writes at one point, this is in his lectures, recently there's been a teacher named Lingzhi Yuan Zhao, and then he puts in small characters, this is pronounced Rinshi, not Reishi, at Senyuji. And it shows very much that Ninku was quite aware of the whole Senyuji tradition, including how they pronounce things. In another passage elsewhere, he talks about the Fusatsu, the fortnightly assembly, which is practiced at Senyuji, and talks about that a little bit. So he's quite aware of who he's criticizing here. He goes on, as a scholar of Vinaya, he wrote some commentaries on the three great treatises of Daoxuan, matching the meaning to Tiantai. And so Senyuji claims that they act like our perfect sudden practitioners so that their merits are said to be like those of Huiyuan and Juri. They cite textual passages and examples of sages to make their point, and thus confuse the purport of the questions and answers presented by Saicho and Ennin. So he sees Senyuji tradition as being somewhat dangerous because it's like Pepsi Cola, it's not the real thing. It just appears to be like Coke. Sorry, bad joke. He, in terms of sort of playing with these things, so he needs to devalue Nirvana Sutra, but it's hard to do, because Nirvana Sutra is going to be a perfect teaching, just like Lotus Sutra. And so what he does is he says, if you look at this, the main purport, the main thrust of Lotus Sutra is criticizing. It's Shakubuku. But the main purport of Nirvana Sutra is Shoju, tolerantly accepting all teachings. And he says, we're going to follow the Shakubuku sort of tradition here. And so we're rejecting Hinayana. At times, he has to allow for kaye to some extent for that sort of more tolerant position. And he says this can be done only under certain conditions. If a monk first receives Hinayana precepts and then converts to Tendai, then you could do it. But most of the time, no, it doesn't work. So he's fairly clear about dividing that. Let's see, how am I doing? I wanted to jump to some of his discussions about Kaitai. He really likes the commentary on Fanwangjing, on Bomo Kyo, that's attributed to Juri, which Sato Tetsue, I think, convincingly argued was clearly not by jury. And I think in recent years, Murakami-san has also made a very convincing argument that this is not by jury. For Ninku, it clearly was by jury, so he accepted it. But he has to reconcile the differences with jury's other works. And the two key areas where they differ is Chinese monks, Sung Dynasty, commentaries on this text, all took what was a threefold exegetical tradition that you found in Juri's commentary on Bomo-kyo, in other words, Sanju Gengi. And they said, no, it has to be expanded to be a fivefold system, to Goju Gengi. Ninku says, no, they've completely misunderstood the thrust of the text. That's not the case. Juri had a special reason for only including Sanju Gengi, or only using that threefold exegetical tradition. And the reason he did it was he wanted to stress the lineage that goes straight from Vairochana, who preaches Bomo-kyo, all the way down to worldlings, Bombu, in a far-off country called Japan during Mapo. The second area that's important here, Sato Tetsue said, if you look at Mohojirgwan Makashkan, you'll see that essence of the precepts is mental. It's not physical. But Ninku really likes the idea that it's quasi-physical. So he uses this term, shomusakeshiki, that appears in the commentary on Bomo-kyo. And he says that's the correct interpretation. And he says, the problem with saying it's provisionally form is that it sounds very much like a Srivastavada Hinayana's position. And he says, that's not what it's about. And then he cites a number of rituals, and he says, when you repent, you have to have a sign from the Buddha, an auspicious sign, a koso, which is sort of quasi-physical. When you undergo the ordination, they see the kaitai approaching you and then finally entering your body. All of this is sort of, for him, this is sort of a form of keshki that he's looking at. So he goes to great deep extent to refute the Sung Dynasty Chinese Tiantai commentaries on this. And what he's doing is he's defending a traditional, what he sees as a traditional Japanese Tendai position. Let's see. Okay, let me try and finish. Whoops, I wanted to. Somehow I lost the section I wanted, but that's okay. Let me just finish. So on the one hand, it seems like Ninku is rejecting all of these things. But on the other hand, he's accepting the influence of Shunjo in a rather amazing way. So he's writing lots of sets of rules of how monks should behave. And these are what he's constantly doing is using Vinaya procedures, not the precepts, but the procedures. So, for example, how do you do a fortnightly assembly? How do you do a rainy season retreat? When is it okay to eat food? And when is it not? Can you eat with other people? Or must you eat with other people? Or can you have your own groups to eat with? If you cannot attend a fortnightly assembly, you must give a proxy. So you have to say, yes, I have observed the precepts, but I'm too sick to come. All of these things that are described in great detail in his sets of temple rules, I think are indirectly a response to Shunjo and the type of monastic discipline that he would bring. So in conclusion, this is a complex story. And I think it tells you a lot about the educational tradition at Rozanji, Sangoji, and some of the other places. And it shows how mixed the sort of influences of Song Dynasty Tiantai could be. Thank you.